Tech of Sports, Episode 8 for May 2nd, 2012. John Lyons from Wilson Sports. This week on the Tech of Sports, John Lyons, the Global Product Director for Wilson Tennis. Netcast Studio mobile apps are a great way to receive our content for your smart devices. There's an app for both iOS and Android. And don't forget the Stitcher Radio app for all iOS devices, Android, BlackBerry, and Palm. Get Stitcher for free with your favorite Netcast Studio shows preloaded. And Stitcher Radio is award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone and tablet. Stitcher, smart radio for your smartphone. And the Tech of Sports is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network at techpodcast.com. If it's tech, it's here. The Tech of Sports is a production of Netcast Studio at netcaststudio.com, where you can join us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific at netcaststudio.com/live. You can join the chat room or listen to the show live. Tonight, we're going to talk a little tennis technology, tennis equipment technology, and because, in my estimation, athletes are always looking for an edge on the court or their field of play, and many times that is with the equipment they use. And we're going to talk about one of the oldest equipment manufacturers in the United States for almost 100 years. Wilson has been making equipment not only for world-class athletes, but for club and recreational athletes as well. From shoes to balls to golf clubs to tennis rackets, accessories, Wilson has really set the standard around the world for sports equipment and, in this case, tennis equipment. And we're going to talk about that and more tonight with John Lyons of Wilson Tennis. At Wilson, John oversees the development of innovative tennis equipment, including rackets, strings, balls, stringing machines. He knows the world of tennis really well. He was a tournament-level tennis player, was a buyer for a large chain of tennis specialty shops, a professional racket stringer on the Pro Tour, and a product manager developing rackets for professional and recreational players. Tennis has experienced many technology changes over, especially over the last 15 years, and we thought it would be great for John to come on and talk about that and where tennis is heading in the future when it comes to technology and equipment. And John, it's great to have you on the show tonight.
Well, thanks, Rick. It's great to great to be here with you.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you one thing. I looked at the history of Wilson a little bit, and it's a very interesting company history, and I'm surprised someone hasn't, maybe they have, I didn't see it, hasn't written a book about it yet. I guess the company, I guess next year you'll be celebrating the 100th year is what it looks like. I'm sure you guys will make a big deal of that. Did you know that back in 1918, when Thomas E. Wilson ran the company, he actually left the company to concentrate on what he thought at that time was his more lucrative beef packing business. And he kind of thought of the Wilson Sports as kind of an afterthought, and it actually became a subsidiary of the beef packing company. He kind of left other people to run it. And, you know, if things would have stayed that way, John, how would you have been at selling beef shanks and ground round?
Yeah, I'd be. We'd be talking about steaks instead of sports equipment. But no, it is pretty interesting. The company that Wilson Sporting Goods grew out of was a company called Ashland Manufacturing. The first company office was on Ashland Avenue in Chicago, and it was the meatpacking area. And, you know, a long time ago, that was the meat processing center of things here in the Midwest. And the Wilson Sporting Goods business basically did grow out of that. The hides of the animals were used to produce different sports balls. Baseballs and footballs and so forth. And one of our very first products actually was natural gut tennis string, which is made from the intestines of the cow. So it actually was a very direct offshoot of that whole meatpacking business.
Yeah, you wouldn't think of those two industries as being related, but when you get down to it, they really are. So pretty interesting. At Wilson, what I think you guys do a great job at is staying at the forefront of tennis technology. You guys are always right on the cutting edge, and you do make great durable products. How far ahead do you guys look? And because sports technology is changing so rapidly these days, how far ahead are you guys planning, changes or new products?
Well, it depends on whether you're talking about evolving current products and making them better through incremental improvements. So that's something we're always trying to do. If you're playing with a particular racket of ours and we can figure out a way to make it, 2% better or 3% better, that's going to give you a little edge. And we make those kind of incremental improvements. And we're thinking 1 year, 2 years out on that kind of development. But our R&D group, there's a group of engineers who's really a big part of their time is spent thinking 3 years out, 4 years out? What are the cutting edge materials or processes or applications or really, you know, big ideas, game changing, the so-called, you know, disruptive technologies that can make things different? Because those don't come along that often. You know, in the history of tennis, there's only really been five or six really big game changers, you know, wood to graphite or to oversize or wide body rackets. And so, you know, in between those big game changers, you know, we're looking to develop those big game changers. We've been lucky. We've had quite a few of those. But in the meantime, you know, right now we're working on rackets for 2013, 2014 that we're trying to make a little better racket. You know, tennis is particularly, you know, at the very competitive level, it's a sport where you play a lot of points in a match and you look at the total number of points that a player wins or loses during a match. And sometimes the winning player only wins three or four more points than the losing player.
Yeah, it's a fine line.
Yeah, little improvements can make a big difference in play. And it's true in every sport, whether it's your golf club and you can, you know, you can sink a couple more putts or keep a few more balls in the fairway. I think it's true with any sport. Incremental improvements can make a big difference too. So we're working several years out on our products.
Yeah, looking back, if we go back and look at the history of rackets, I guess there's a few different eras. And you know, my father grew up playing in the 50s and 60s and 70s. He was a tournament player, and it was all pretty much wood then. And he'll tell you there really wasn't much difference between the wood frames of that day. But then things changed when, you know, different materials started being used, and then prints came out with the oversized rackets. I mean, tennis rackets changed in size, I mean, too, which, I mean, how many sports does the tool you use actually change in size? That's kind of rare. How much did that and the switch to aluminum, metal, composite, and other materials, how much did that actually change the sport in your estimation?
Well, I think it changed the sport tremendously for the avid recreational or, social player. And it certainly has changed the pro player's game a lot. The big change from wood to any other material, the big change they made is that, you know, when we made a wood racket, we took 7 or 8 or 9 strips. They were called plies of wood, and they would soak these in a chemical bath to soften them up. And then they would bend them around a form. And that's how a wooden racket essentially got made. And there were real limits to how big you could make the racket. There was a reason those rackets were all very similar in size and weight, because there wasn't the possibility to bend that wood around a bigger size or shape. There were a few attempts at it, but it really wouldn't work. As soon as aluminum, actually steel at first, but as soon as aluminum came into play, aircraft aluminum, now you didn't have that limitation. And you're absolutely right. Prince came up with Howard Head, actually, who invented the aluminum
skiing
and foam. He's the same guy that came up with the oversized tennis racket, and the story is that he was a recreational tennis player and was, you know, didn't feel the equipment worked right, and he went out and rethought it and came up with this idea of a bigger head. And it was actually not just about making the head bigger; it was making the sweet spot, as we call it, of the racket in the right location. It wasn't just making it bigger; it was making it in the right place. But that began a change of things, and suddenly the door was open to changing the size and the shape of rackets. And then, but the rackets were still, aluminum was still pretty flexible. So when the racket bends a lot, whether it's wood or aluminum, all the energy that goes into making the racket bend never goes back into the ball. Ball's on the strings for about 4 or 5 1,000ths of a second. And when a racket bends, like a wood or aluminum racket, the racket's still bending backwards and the ball's going away. So that was lost energy. When we made the transition to carbon fiber, to graphite, fiberglass, and so forth, that was the next big change, because now we could make the racket in any shape, but we could also make the racket so that it didn't bend as much and it was stiffer, and more of that energy went back into the ball. And it's kind of interesting, because everybody thinks, hey, the pro players, they hit the ball so much harder because of the change in the equipment. And there's absolutely that factor, but I'll tell you that it is very interesting. The pro players, they are not using the really big heads. They're not using the super stiff rackets. I think some of what's happened with the pro players hitting the ball a lot harder is better conditioning. The players are physically better, better training. And yeah, the equipment helps. I think it makes a much bigger difference for the recreational player, honestly, than it does. It's adding a lot more miles per hour to my game than it is to Roger Federer's game.
Yeah, we'll talk about this a little later. And I've talked with players and current players and older players. And just a little teaser for later in the show, they say the strings maybe make more of a difference than the rackets, but we'll talk about that. But moving on with kind of the history of tennis rackets, maybe 10 to 15 years ago, the trend all of a sudden went to, you know, wide body or thicker frames. and where recreational players really benefited from that. I mean, any club you went to, every recreational player had broken out a wide body racket, but some of the pros tried it, and it just didn't work for them. Why didn't that really take off with the pros, and when it did with the recreational and club players?
So it actually ties a lot into what I just described of how we made the rackets so they wouldn't bend as much.
Okay.
And we got to some limit of making a racket where the let's just say along the shaft of the racket, the tip, it was the same, let's say 22 millimeters wide. And we had reached some limit of being able to make the racket stiffer and return energy to the ball. And actually a fellow in Germany named Kubler was the guy's last name, came with up with the idea of the racket didn't have to be the same width all the way through the racket. And he noticed that the racket was bending basically around what we call the shoulders of the racket, right at the bottom of the strings is where most of the bending was happening. And he came up with the idea of shaping the racket so it was wider in that spot. So if you looked at our profile racket, which was the first wide body racket, it was narrowed down by the grip, and then it got much wider about at where the string started, and then it went narrower again. We called it a dual taper. It tapered wider and then narrower. And what this did is this, again, reinforced the power level of the racket. So the racket was able to go up another step in power level. The reason that it didn't really honestly catch on with the pro players is they didn't need that much power. The pro players have a very big swing. They have a long, big, fast swing, and they're generating most of the power that they need. And when pro players tried those much more powerful rackets, what happened is the ball began to fly on them, and they would kind of shorten up their stroke and guide the ball more. And a pro player wants to be able to swing as hard as they can, particularly in the men's game now. They want to swing as hard as they can and swing all out at the ball. And if the racket returns too much energy back to the ball, the player gets a sense of not being able to control the ball. And, essentially, you talk about what's control. I would say control is your ability to put the ball where you want. But what most people think of control is did the ball go too far? Did it go beyond the baseline? And when you get too powerful a racket and the ball's flying too far, that's not a feel that a pro player wants. So the pro players found that there was some level of power that they could use and get, and they didn't really need that wider frame. I will say, though, trends like that wider racket did inch into the pro game so that the rackets right. that the pros players are using now are wider. They're not as wide as that old profile, but they are much wider than what like our original pro staff racket was, our graphite pro staff racket that Jimmy Connors or Chris Everett used.
Yeah, I think the couple players that did try it were kind of the smaller players in stature. I think, Michael Chang kind of dabbled with that, and maybe a player that's still playing today, Oliver Rokas, I think he kind of tried the wide body a little bit. I think the little guys did maybe to try to generate a little more power, and maybe their strokes kind of allowed that a little bit. But that was really about it. I think a double specialist, I think Jim Pugh, I think, used a wide body. And I think he used it just because he volleyed just about all the time, and the racket did all the work for him. So
yeah, Jim had a very short, he had a very short, compact stroke. He didn't take a big swing at the ball. And it was, guide it back where you want, get into the net, and finish the point. And that probably worked a lot better in doubles. What's interesting, you mentioned two smaller players, and one trend that did happen, and we still make them, is rackets got a little longer for a while there. In addition to making the heads bigger and the rackets stiffer, for a couple of years, all of the brands were trying the standard inch, standard length rackets, 27 inches long. The rules of the game allow you to go up to 29 inches long. So for a while, we're making longer rackets. And there are some of the players, and Rokas is one of them, he's still playing, and he still uses a little bit longer racket. We make them 27 and a quarter, 27 and a half. We make a couple that are 28. A lot of these trends, they start off sort of at the extreme, and then they come back. Racket heads got very big, then they came back. Rackets got very wide, and then they came back. Rackets got longer, then they came. So like a lot of – it's similar in golf. Big-headed drivers got enormous, and then they kind of came back. So similar trend. I will say, yeah, absolutely. Players are looking for any advantage they can get when they just need a few more points. They are open to, experimenting with their equipment a little bit to try to find ways to get a little edge.
That kind of takes me into my next question. And how different are the rackets that I know there? A lot of these pros are rackets are customized for these pros, especially the top ones. But how different are the rackets that they're using, on center court at Wimbledon than what the average fan or player can go to their local Dick's Sporting Goods or local sporting goods store and buy off the internet? How different are they?
Well, the main difference, most players on the tour, I won't say every player, but most players on the tour, the starting point of the frame itself, the carbon fiber that's underneath the paint, is basically what you can buy on the shelf. The biggest difference is the players are just physically bigger and stronger and better conditioned. So most players do play with a little bit heavier racket than you or I would play with. And so the answer of can you buy the same racket, it's kind of like a yes and a no. You can't buy the exact same racket that, for example, Roger Federer uses. But if you buy one off the shelf and you add 10, I'm going to say it's 10 or 12 grams, I don't know off the top of my head, of extra weight to that racket, you're going to be playing with his spec, because that's all he does. He adds a little more weight to the racket because he's able to handle the extra weight. Some players add a lot more weight. We do that, and any consumer can do it themselves. You do it with a lead tape.
Yep.
You pull out the bumper, which is the plastic thing on the top of the racket. You can pull that back, put a little lead tape underneath there. You got to measure how many grams it is. And, you can get your racket to be the same weight, and balance is another big point, where you put that weight. So most players, what we're doing is we're making the rackets a little heavier. The one other thing that's different for pro players is, of course, they're a little bit more sensitive to variations in the equipment. When we make a racket, just like making any product in the world, when we make a racket, there is a tolerance. In fact, it's plus or minus 7 grams for us and almost every other brand in the world. There is a tolerance. You and I could not feel 5 or 7 grams of difference in the weight of that racket, but a pro player might be able to feel that. So one of the things that we do for the pro players is if they got 12 rackets in the bag, we make them so that they're, and this is the tuning part of it, we make them so that they're all exactly identical. It's not that we're making something radically different for that player. It's that they're all, that when they go in the bag and they pick up another racket, it's got to be dead on the same. I used to work for another brand, and I was in charge of Agassi's rackets at the time, and I had never found a player that could get below even a pro player could feel below five grams of weight difference in a racket. Agassi could feel 3 grams of difference. If I gave him 2 rackets and put 3 extra grams of weight in one of his rackets, and you're talking a 330-gram racket, so you're talking less than 1%, he could pick out the one that was 3 grams heavier. But most pros can't even feel 5 grams of weight difference. But they don't want it in their mind. They don't want to think there's any variation. So we just make sure they're exactly the same. And again, that's something that a good technician at a tennis shop can do for you if you wanted. If you had 2 rackets and you brought them in, they could put them on a scale and check the balance point and play around with a little bit of lead tape. And they could make them so that they're all the same, and they could make them a little bit heavier for you.
So at the tournaments, do the stringers, and do they all have like a filing system on all the players? And when they get a racket to string from a certain player, they just look up that player, what they string it at? Is that how they do it? Because I saw last year, I'm not going to name players, but I saw players in Cincinnati at the Western and Southern Open standing in line at the Tennis Express tent buying, 2-3 rackets that I guess they were planning on using or whatever. And I guess they take them to the tent and have them customize it or whatever for them. But do they know what to do for particular players?
Usually there's not a whole lot of that tuning going on. We're the official stringer of the U.S. Open, Australian Open, and a bunch of other tournaments. So the U.S. Open in New York, we string, it's 2.5 weeks because it's a qualifying event. We string about 4,000 rackets during the 2.5 weeks. We have 15 guys there from around the world, about 50 best stringers in the world there working the whole tournament. We do have I'll take all the measurements on the racket. So if a player came in and said, hey, I've got 4 rackets, I just got a couple of new ones, can you make sure that they're dead on? We could do it for them on site, but most players don't do that stuff during a tournament. It's either done by the brand, like Wilson, or if you're a very top player, there's a couple of guys in the world who make a living off of doing this for the pro players.
Yep.
And a couple of them are here in the U.S. One of the guys is in New York. Roman Prokes is the fellow who does the tuning for a lot of the pro players, and you could go to his shop in New York, and he'd do the same service for you if you wanted it for a fee. So those players are generally showing up, whether we got the rackets right and dead on balance and weight and everything for the player, or whether they had it done by somebody else. And you got to be if you're not top 10 or 15, you're not going to somebody else to get this done.
Sure.
But there is this myth that the players play with some, boy, they have some special – racket that I can't possibly get. It's really not that at all. It's basically that they, you know, they can swing a heavier stick. And I think it's probably that way in a lot of other sports too, you know. I'm pretty sure a Major League Baseball player might swing a heavier bat than what you or I could swing if we were going out in the softball field right now.
Yeah, I think tennis and golf are linked a lot, and I don't think there's any sport where technology is talked about more than in golf. And I guess because people are always looking, even, you know, the players out at the local public course are looking to improve every aspect of their golf game. But I think the going high tech helped the sport of golf. Going high tech help the sport of tennis and make it more popular? Because it kind of leveled off there after, you know, the wood racket era kind of ended. That was kind of the peak of tennis, especially here in the United States. And it's, you know, like anything else, it goes up and down. It's a, you know, there's a little effect there, but I think it helped, you know, on the rec level and also a touch on juniors and making rackets for juniors. Cause I think for a long time, juniors really didn't have a decent racket they can use. And no one ever wants to talk about this, but I always thought part of the problem with developing players here in the United States was that junior rackets were made so poorly, and they didn't have many options. And I think for a couple generations, that hurt developing tennis players in this country.
Yeah, if you were an 8-year-old kid, you know, if you went back, you're absolutely right. If you went back, you know, 15 years, your option was buy an adult racket or buy a shorter racket for sure that was better for your size, but it was an aluminum racket that was, you know, a $30 racket. We now, and the other brands we make now, you know, full graphite, high performance rackets. They're around $100, $110, $95, something like that. But they're full performance graphite rackets that are just shorter and play just as well as our adult rackets. They just have smaller grips and shorter lengths. And so if anybody's listening, they got kids, the single best thing you can do for your kid is make sure that they get the right size racket to start with. And there is a very big push in the United States in tennis to grow the game again, kids into the game. I know when my kids started soccer, they showed up, had one practice, and they said, hey, we have a game on Saturday. And I said, aren't we going to have a few more practices first? They said, no, we're going to go play a game. And I think part of the problem with tennis is you had to take, you know, 6 months of lessons before we let you play a match. So I think there's a whole move to try to get kids playing quickly and make it easier. Mm-hmm. And the technology has definitely helped the adults too. It's easier for an adult player to pick up the modern, lightweight, very powerful racket. And if they can make contact with the ball, it's probably going to go over the net. So the technology has absolutely helped the game. I think the game, you're right, hit its peak in the late 70s, early 80s. But I don't think that the technology, the rackets, was so much a factor. And I think the game got popular because we had some great personalities.
Sure.
And you know, you had Connors and McEnroe, and the sport just got hot. If you look at the history of tennis and golf, they seem to go up and down. It looks like two sine waves. One goes up, the other one goes down. And golf gets hot for a while, and people try golf. Golf's a great game. And people find out, hey, you know, I don't have 5 hours to play. What else can I try? And then they try tennis because they can get a little exercise in an hour. And so it does go in cycles. Tennis is actually on an upswing in the U.S. The participation in the game has been growing for the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, and about going back to the juniors real quick, I know the USTA sat around for years and were brainstorming on how to get juniors more involved. And you mentioned that, you know, they want to play games and they want to play against somebody. And, you know, that's just that's a society trend, not just a tennis trend. And they came up with the 10 and under tennis initiative, and it's something new, and they don't know where it's going, and we don't know what the results are going to be on that. But what's Wilson's stance on that? Did they go to Wilson and talk about that with you guys when they really made that push?
We're absolutely very involved in that. And I'll be honest, all of the brands, because we have a real interest in growing the game of tennis. We're the number one brand worldwide. If there's more tennis players, that's in our best interest. But I think what's interesting about this new push is it's not just that the kids need shorter rackets. One of the problems is no matter how long the racket is, if we give them a normal ball, the ball bounces too high and too fast for a little kid. So it's now not just the rackets, but it's using different balls that are lower compression. They're actually a little bigger too. And so there's different stages. There's three stages of ball. So as the kids are little, it's a little bit bigger ball. It's a very soft ball. And we basically make a smaller court for them too. Using the analogy of my kids again, you know, one of my kids started soccer in my local community, and they were playing on the enormous field with full-size nets. And about once every hour, someone would get the ball far enough down the other end to score a goal. And then the next year, they went to these little tiny fields with these little small nets with no goalies, and all the parents were up and, you know, were all upset because they're not playing real soccer. And really, it was the European model of how to get kids into soccer. That, look, you've got to have fewer kids in the field, play on a smaller size field at their size, don't have a goalie playing defense, don't even let the kids go near, you know, go into too close to the net. And it was all just shrinking the whole sport down to their size. And this is what this whole 10 and under thing is. It's getting the court the right size, so the little kids are playing side to side, not end to end. They're playing on, you know, 27 feet side to side over a portable net. To start with a very soft ball that doesn't bounce too high for them, and then as they get a little bigger, now they're playing over the regular nets. The net's now 3 feet high, and they're playing using part of the court. But it's all in scale to the players as they grow and get closer and closer to a full size racket, a full size ball, a full size court. It would, you know, and this system makes total sense. I know the USTA is very behind this, and they've actually mandated now that at certain age groups, the kids that play in want to play competitively and want to play tournaments have to play with these balls, these length rackets, and these size courts. So you're not going to have 8-year-old kids out there playing in competition on a, you know, full size tennis court, and you know, the sport's just not very much fun for them. Tennis is not an easy game for kids to pick up.
Yeah, we'll see what happens with it. I mean, it's all the questions are unanswered right now. And I know as an adult, I've been at some of the media tournaments and they play the media tournament on the little courts, and I've played it. And it is fun, and I can see how kids, you know, have fun doing it. But, I mean, for generations and generations, I mean, John McEnroe didn't grow up playing. I mean, Pete Sampras didn't grow up playing on that. They played with full-size rackets. The Williams sisters didn't do that. So, I mean, we'll see what happens with it. But, I mean, for years and years, players didn't do that. And we in America developed players, you know, perfectly fine. So, you know, it wasn't the USTA doing it. It was, you know, individuals developing it. But, you know, you could go on and talk about that all day. And we'll just have to see what happens with that.
Yeah, I think that there was a model in the U.S. That got very good results, which was the academy model. It started with a guy named Nick Bollettieri in Florida, and you know, the better juniors went there and lived there and trained there and went to school around their tennis. And you know, you can debate whether that's good or bad, but you know, that model, which Nick Bollettieri really sort of started. Spread very quickly in Europe, and some of the best tennis academies where kids go to live and train are in Europe now, in Spain and in France and so forth. And you know, I think the other countries in the world, you know, they kind of caught up to that model, and maybe we took our eyes off the ball, if you pardon the pun, here in the U.S. Yep. And you know, you wish there were more young American players, you know, in the top 50. It's a lot of Eastern Europeans and Latin American players, but that's kind of what the game is now. And I think the USTA, they're trying, and I think their plan is they got to get more kids into the sport. It's kind of like a funnel. If you get enough players coming in one end of the funnel, you're going to get some really good ones coming out the other end.
Yeah, the academy model was good because you had a bunch of kids that were all pushing each other. And we don't have that right now, so we'll just see what happens with that.
McEnroe started at the Harry Hopman Tennis Academy. That's where he sort of got his game together when he was a kid. And Harry Hopman was an Australian guy that was a coach for all the Australian legends and came to the U.S. and started academy here. So actually, some of these ideas are just, you know, moving around the world.
Yep. We'll give you a break here for a second, John. Get a sip of water, and I'll do a little spot here for Amazon.com. And if you're doing any shopping in the coming months, Mother's Day, Father's Day, for Amazon.com, NetcastStudio.com has an affiliate link you can use, and it's NetcastStudio.com/Amazon. There's no extra cost to you, and it's easy to order off of that. And I always try to plug a product that you can buy off of Amazon. And since we're talking about tennis, there's no better product to talk about than the Bud Collins History of Tennis, the big encyclopedia and record book he put out in 2010. And it really is, it's a tennis junkie's dream. All the historical information, year-by-year recaps, biographies of all the players, stats, records, and Bud Collins put his name on it. So you know that for the tennis fan, it's pretty tennis intensive. So it's always a great product. And that's at netcaststudio.com/Amazon. And John, tell the listeners how they can learn more about the Wilson products you guys offer for tennis and keep up with the Wilson product lines. Here's your chance.
Head over to wilson.com. You'll see all of our sports on the homepage. You know, we're in a lot of sports, baseball, football, basketball. Just select tennis. That'll get you to tennis homepage, and you can learn more about our products, more about our athletes, more about things that we've got going on. And you can certainly, from that location, follow us on Facebook and Twitter and all the usual social media.
Yeah, you guys always have contests going on, promotions, deals, and, you know, once they get all signed up with you guys, they'll get all the emails and all the information they want, and the giveaways and promotions you guys run are all great, great stuff. So I encourage all the people to follow all the Wilson stuff on social media. You guys do a good job with that.
There's some terrific stuff on our YouTube channel as well. If you want to see some of the behind the scenes stuff,
sure.
There's some really fun stuff. We did some recently where we're in the players' hotel rooms and looking kind of what do you do while you're hanging out in a hotel room and what's in your bag and what kind of music do you listen to? And, you know, so there's that personal and human side of it all as well that's kind of fun to learn about if you're a tennis nut.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you had any input in there, came up with the idea for that Wilson couch, those series of ads when Federer and Serena were drilling the people on the couches. Those were classics. I love those. And it was great that the Wilson couch went and toured around to the tournaments where people could sit on it. That was a great promotion for you guys.
Yeah, we have that couch outside our permanent store at the U.S. Open, and there must be about 3,000 people a day that go sit on the couch and have somebody take a picture of them on the couch. So that was kind of a fun promotion.
Yeah, that was great. We talked about it a little earlier. Strings have become so important, and the players are really particular, and so much has happened with strings. It used to be, when I played high school tennis and tournaments and, you know, on a budget, you'd tell the stringer to put some Leona 66 in the frame and you'd play for about a week and then it would break and then you'd go get it in there again. You know, what do you guys do as far as strings and the input from players and where are strings going right now?
Well, if you're talking about the pro tour, and there's a very, very definite direction in strings. And probably for the serious competitive player as well. And I would actually, we talked about racket innovations at the beginning. And, racket innovations, we're always trying to figure out something new. Racket innovations in the last 4 or 5 years, the biggest innovation for the serious advanced players, the pro players, actually has been the string. We are the worldwide distributor. We sell a string brand called Luxalon. It's a small Belgian company that makes a very, very high-tech product, and these guys basically revolutionized string on the pro tour. About 78% of the ATP top 250 men and 65% of the WTA top 250 women use a string from this company. Generically, everybody tends to call it polyester. In fact, the secret of Luxalon strings is they're not made of polyester. They're made of a different material. They're made of PEEK, which is a different kind of material. But we can generically use the word poly to mean that kind of string. It's a single thick strand of what appears to be a pretty firm and stiff material. It started off for durability, but as players 10, 15 years ago began to get used to the string, what they found is that they can generate more spin with the string. And the game is changing, really. The effect of this type of string on the program has been spin. There's absolutely empirical evidence that this type of string does generate more spin. It's not the reason that most people think. Most people think if the string is really rough like sandpaper, that would create more spin. What happens is that when you hit a ball and you're trying to hit with a lot of spin, the string moves, and on this type of string, it snaps back into position while the ball is still in contact with the strings, and that imparts extra spin on that ball. So when pro players began trying this stuff, they began to say that, I can really curve shape the ball more. The last 2-3 feet of the ball's path, it's really dropping down into the court, so they're creating more topspin. And what that will allow the pro players to do, frankly, is swing out, swing aggressively, and keep that ball in the court. So really the biggest – I think the biggest single change in the pro game, and, you know, this is college players, series juniors, in a long time has been the strings. And it's definitely had a very, very big effect in the game. I would not say that that string is ideal for everybody. Some recreational players try it and they find, you know, gee, I really don't get much more spin. You've got to be a good player swinging pretty fast. You got to have the right swing to generate spin. If you have a very flat swing, this string is not going to magically create spin. But if you have kind of a vertical swing where you're brushing up the back of the ball, you're going to be able to load it up with more spin with this kind of string.
Yeah, strings have really come a long way, and it's just amazing. And I used to use some string. It was called UFO. It was some sort of pink string, and the only reason it actually played pretty well, but the only reason people wanted to use it, it was pink, and it was different, and it really stood out. And I remember back those days.
Yeah, no, I remember that same string actually. That's a pretty good. That's pretty good. It was by the same Major Leona 66 actually, and they're still in business. They still have
absolutely.
Those strings.
Absolutely. You guys currently have the number one women's player in the world, Victoria Azarenka. She's a Wilson player, and for years and years you've had Roger Federer since, you know, for as long as anyone remembers Federer playing, you know, since he was, I don't know how old, a young kid. He's been a Wilson player. What does that mean for Wilson to have, you know, you have other players as well, but those two players right now, you know, being Wilson players?
You know, they're great. Talk about Federer first. He's just a terrific ambassador for our brand. You know, you couldn't find a better, nicer, more professional athlete to want to have. And we've got a lot of great athletes. Wilson as a brand has a lot of great athletes in all different sports. Roger is number one. He's, you know, arguably the greatest. We call him the GOAT, greatest of all time. You know, arguably the greatest. You look at his results, and you know, you can debate other players now that have, you know, in the last few years have been beating him. But if you look at the full body of work, it's pretty hard not to say that Roger, if not the greatest, is certainly one of the greatest players of all time. And yet here he is, still out there. He loves the game. He's not talking about, you know, he's just turned 30. He's not talking about I'm done or I'm going to just play another year or two. He really enjoys the sport of tennis. He paces himself. He's in great shape. He's probably been a little lucky that he's never had an injury, but if you look at the way that he plays, he's very smooth. You know, just look at the way he moves around the court. He never looks like he's over swinging. You know, he's always on balance. And the single thing that when I say people say, what should I try to copy that Roger does? Watch Roger warming up and watch his head. And Roger watches the ball come into his contact point where he's contacting the ball, and his head stays down long after the ball is gone. And he probably does that. It's a simple thing that teaching pros tell players all the time. Don't lift your head up, just like golf. Don't lift your head up to see where the ball goes. Keep your head down, look through the contact point. And he does that probably better than any player I've ever seen. And you really see it in the warm-up, not moving so fast. But he's a pleasure to work with. He when we have a request for him to do an event for us and sign autographs or make an appearance somewhere, he's a guy that – we'll stay longer and interact with people. You know, some of these parties or events that we throw for dealers or something, you know, we'll have players come in and we'll have a VIP section. The players don't want to be bothered with the average person. Roger's one of those guys. He'll be the first one to say, yeah, let me go over and, you know, shake some hands and take some pictures. And he's a total class act and, you know, happens to be one of the greatest players ever. So he's been really terrific for our sport. Victoria Azarenka, she's a recently came to us, switched rackets just before the Australian Open, had been playing with another racket, a good racket, and switched to a Wilson racket. She obviously had been play testing, and she did play Wilson younger when she was a junior, and began playing with a new racket that we were just coming out with, and just hit it and really liked it, and switched pretty quickly. And sometimes for these players, switching is not an easy thing. She went on a tear. She won the Australian Open, won 26 or 27 matches in a row. She's, you know, now the dominant number one in the world. Actually, at the time, we had another player called Petra Kvitova, who was also battling for number one in the world. And, you know, for a while, we were thinking, hey, Petra's going to get to be number one. And here comes Azarenka. And, you know, so now we actually have two of the top three women players in the world. And they're both young and very engaging. You know, when you got a player on your brand, you want him to be a class person that represents your brand well.
Yeah, there's no more class person than Federer, and he's one of those people that he's like the Beatles. When people actually meet him, they almost like melt. And he really is a great ambassador, and everybody loves him. And I think he's going to keep playing. He doesn't talk about when people ask him about the Olympics. He's not talking about the Olympics coming up right now in London. He's talking about the one 4 years from now in Brazil. So he'll be with you guys for a while, and I think a lot of the good advice he's gotten as far as his scheduling and rackets and stuff. I think he talked a lot with Pete Sampras, and Pete advised him kind of under the radar a little bit pretty well. So that's great. How about quickly we'll finish up here with talking about maybe other accessories like grips and stringing machines and balls. Is there anything new coming with that?
The ball is, the ball is a very, regulated sort of thing. That's all about quality and consistency. We make a great hardcourt ball. We're the official ball of we used at the U.S. Open. We're used at the Australian Open, two of the four Grand Slams. So we're enjoying good success on the ball side. It's kind of hard to innovate on the ball. It's round. The biggest innovation in the ball was when they went from white to yellow, yeah, which was a well innovation. But really, the ball's more about consistency, so they all play the same. We ran a great print ad. One of our ad guys came with a great print ad that had a player, throwing the ball back to the ball kid, and the ad said, when the player takes the three balls and throws one back to the ball kid, yeah, that's stalling because the balls are all the same. But balls, it's kind of hard to innovate. I think, one of the things with balls is, getting the right ball for the surface, whether you're playing on clay, whether you're playing indoors, whether you're playing on hard courts. In terms of, we talked about strings, there is lots of innovation going on string, and I think there's more coming. We have a string. It is not on the market yet, but it's getting buzz on the tour. And so we have a new string from Luxalon coming up in the fall. We'll be delivering ups, and it's pretty much the rage on the tour. Serena just switched to it. A lot of our players have switched this string. And a lot of players that aren't with us, who, by the way, we don't pay any of these players to use this string. If you're a Wilson player, we're giving you some for free, we charge them what we charge your local tennis shop, and they still buy it. So, we keep trying to innovate, come up with new things in the grips. Interestingly, we mentioned golf. I think golf is a little bit more of a tinkerer's game, where people will, customize and play around with the equipment and find things. Tennis hasn't really been that way, but I do think long-term, that's kind of maybe one of the directions that the equipment will probably go is players being able to tinker a little bit more with their equipment and get it just the way they want it. So that's one of the things we're thinking about long term is how do we bring a little more of what we do, and I told you about in kind of the pro tour, how do we bring a little bit more of that to the average player, and can that help the average player?
Yeah, the one thing I'm waiting for, and maybe it's been done, but I haven't seen it, and I'll give you guys an idea here. How about pink tennis balls for like the women's tournaments during like the breast cancer month? Awareness. Why hasn't that been done yet?
We do make pink tennis balls, and we absolutely do. We have an association with the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, and we make products that we donate a percentage of. It's a great cause of support, and we actually do make pink balls, and they're used a little bit. I think the women pro players would probably have an issue if we went to pink balls. It's a really interesting question because the other pro sports. You watch a baseball game or football game, and they somehow have got all the players going pink for one weekend or one game or something. I think tennis should maybe take a page from the other sports books on that. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, bring that up at the next meeting or something, John, and maybe you can do something about that. All right.
You're glad of it.
Okay, and the last question here, I always ask all my guests, the one piece of modern technology, either in your professional or personal life, that you can't live without.
I'm so disappointing on this one. There should be some crazy gadget that's my answer. But honestly, I'd seen that question. For me, I travel a lot. I'm most of my travels outside, outside the U.S. My position's global, so I'm in Asia a lot. I'm in Europe a lot. I'm in Latin America a lot. And for me, it's the iPad. I hate to say it, but it's an easy answer. I don't have to carry a laptop with me most places because I can. I've got my email. I can work on a document if I need it. If I've got Dropbox or some other cloud-based, I use Dropbox, but you know, I can get my documents if I really need something that I've got to, you know, do a little more powerful work with. I can borrow a laptop if I have to. So I pretty much travel the world with it with an iPad. It's how I take my notes. It's how I get my entertainment. 14 hours on an airplane. I don't like the movies. I've seen them before. I got a couple of them on my iPad. So I think it's just for me, it's the one thing that if I forgot it and went on a trip, it'd be a long flight.
You're the first guest that said iPad, John, and I agree with you. It's mine too. And it's great. And the battery life is great on it. That's the best part about it, I think. So give Wilson one more, give you another chance to mention the website and we'll go from there.
Indeed. Remember wilson.com. We invite any of your readers to come to our site, learn more about our products and follow us on your favorite social media and find out some fun things behind the scenes about your favorite athletes, whether they're tennis players or whether it's Derrick Rose or whether it's one of our baseball players or our many other sports.
Yeah, great. Well, you gave a lot of great inside information tonight too, John, and really appreciate it and appreciate all the people at Wilson, all the work you guys do.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
And that'll wrap it up for tonight. And just a reminder, the Netcast Studio has many other shows which may be of interest to you. You can head over to netcaststudio.com and check those out. Waves of Tech will be coming up next if you've been listening live. And you're listening to the Tech of Sports podcast, a Netcast Studio production.